Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Ben Young, it's Here and Now. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein is no longer in U.S. custody. He has been handed over to Iraqi officials, and there are reports that he will be put to death by hanging within hours. Saddam was sentenced to death on November 5th for the 1982 murders of 148 boys and men in the Shiite city of Dujail. On Tuesday, an appeals court upheld the death sentence, clearing the way for Saddam to be hanged within 30 days. But as we've said, that process has already begun. First today, how are Iraqis reacting to this news? Larry Kaplow is in Baghdad for Cox Newspapers. We turn to him now. Larry, we've been talking to you today. I know you've been out on the streets in Baghdad, and you told us earlier today that Iraqis were largely preoccupied with their own problems. But now, of course, we've heard of this transfer. So give us a sense of the streets, at least as what you can tell.
Well, right now it's 8 o'clock at night here, and the streets are almost empty. There's a nightly curfew that starts at 9 o'clock in just under an hour. And I'm sure that's part of the intention, if they are going ahead with this execution tonight, is to do it when there is a curfew in place. It'll go through at least tomorrow morning. So at this point, I think Iraqis are at home. The ones that have electricity are trying to keep track of this on TV.
And that's very few of them. I mean, that's one of the things you found earlier today, that people are so beaten down by their own issues, they didn't seem as concerned about Saddam.
Yes, I was out just a couple hours ago, and in Baghdad, that's certainly the case. I think Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds are all more concerned about how they're going to get home alive. That's what a few told me, is that they're just so dispirited by the way the city is, that this isn't at the front of their minds. I would expect a different reaction in the north and in the south. In the Kurdish area in the north, in the southern Shiite areas, there is more security. There's more semblance of normal life. And I believe for sure we'll see scenes from there after the execution of people celebrating the Saddam's demise.
Is there concern also that Saddam supporters might take to the streets?
There is that concern. That will be part of the security measures that I expect to see put in place after this happens. That in the last, when he was convicted on November 5th of crimes against humanity, there were some outbursts in the northern town of Tikrit, which is his homeland, and in some other Sunni areas. But I think, there's a suicide bombing in Baghdad pretty much every day, sometimes two or three. So I don't know if there'll be a radical spike in the violence that already exists.
Well, Larry, some of critics around the world, human rights groups, governments, the Vatican, have criticized the rush to execution, but we understand that the Muslim religious holiday Eid al-Adha, which is the second biggest religious festival, starts at sundown on Saturday. And I'm just wondering, there are international and Iraqi laws against executing a leader on a religious holiday. Is that part of, you know, what some are saying is this rush to execution?
I believe that it would be part of it, not to say that they wouldn't necessarily do it during the holiday or on the eve of the holiday if they wanted to. But mainly, I think this Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and what he views as his constituency, which are Shiites who've come back to Iraq or risen back to power in Iraq and were punished under the old regime, I think he just wants to do this very quickly. He thought the court was dithering and taking too long getting to his conviction, and he wants to show that he's in control and able to do this with speed.
Well, Larry, we're going to be speaking to a legal scholar a little later in the program, but one last question in the minute we have. Some people are wondering whether or not this execution will be televised or photographed. And you say that there is a parallel to another Iraqi story that may come in handy in understanding what might happen next.
Well, in 1963, Abdel Karim Qasim was the president. He was captured in a coup. They marched him up to a television studio, held a short trial in a couple of hours, and then riddled him with bullets and turned on one of the cameras and held his lifeless face up to the camera. And we've also seen the U.S. forces show pictures of Odeh and Qusay Hussein after they were killed in Mosul in 2003. People here want to see proof of what they're being told. I expect that at some point pictures or video of this will leak out or be put out intentionally on state television.
Larry Kaplow of Cox Newspaper speaking to us from Baghdad about what is now the imminent execution of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Again, we'll have more later in the program from a legal scholar who helped set up the tribunal that tried Saddam. Larry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, this month's desperate search for three climbers lost on Oregon's Mount Hood and this week's discovery of the body of elite climber Charlie Fowler on a mountain in China are reminders of the high cost of that sport. But they also brought to mind a conversation we had last year with adventure writer David Roberts, whose book title hints at his story. It's called On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. By the time he was 22, David Roberts had watched two of his climbing partners die in fatal plunges. He was also on the scene when two other mountaineers, roped together, fell to their deaths. But like most climbers, it didn't deter him. In fact, in 1980, he published a piece for Outside Magazine in which he explained why he kept climbing. The tentative title was Worth the Risk. Well, then, a change of heart. As he explained in his book and in our conversation last December, he now asks, worth the risk to whom?
In moments of doubt, as that piece ended up being called, I essentially analyzed the question, is it worth the risk, strictly in terms of myself? Do the thrills outweigh the terrors and the losses? But it took me decades to realize that that was too simplistic and even narcissistic a way to go at it. That what I really needed to question was, what is the impact on those left behind, siblings, parents, when someone dies in the mountains? Mm-hmm. And so I actually went back and interviewed certain people who had been deeply hurt by these losses and came to a different, not a simple reversal of my previous conclusion, but I hope a more ambiguous and nuanced conclusion.
Yeah, it certainly is. I'm wondering if you can read us a section from the beginning of the book. When you talk about the death of your first climbing partner, Gabe, you were only 18 years old at the time. Can you set up the scene? Where are you and Gabe? Mm-hmm.
As this passage begins, Gabe and I are two-thirds of the way up at the first Flatiron, which is a 700-foot cliff. But our rope has gotten jammed, creating a terrible dilemma, how to get to the place where it's stuck and unjam it.
Mm. And are you tied together? Or he's...
We were originally tied together, but to try to get the rope loose, I untied and flung the rope, hoping to snap it loose. Didn't work. But now we're now standing out of sight of each other, trying to figure out what to do. The rope is stuck below him some 60 feet, and finally he says that he thinks he can climb down to it. Gabe's voice had an unfamiliar, choked urgency. I just got past a hard place, he said, but now it's easier. I guessed that he had climbed to within 25 feet of my shelf of safety. My brain whispered, bring up the rope, Gabe, and we'll be all right. I waited and stared. Far out above the plains, a hawk danced in circles on an updraft, mocking our gravity-bound plight. The sun blazed on my back and neck. A sound I had never heard before seized my ears, yet I knew at once what it was. It was the sound of cloth sliding against rock. Dave! Gabe screamed. Gabe's cry came up to me even as his body accelerated away. No! Oh, no! He began to bounce, the terrible arc of his trajectory longer after each impact. 400 feet below, he sailed upside down through the empty air, hit the cliff head first, and was flung into the treetops at the base of the Flatiron.
Reading that is sickening. Is it?
Yeah, it's hard for me to read.
I imagine.
It's upsetting still.
And yet there were decades when you pushed some of those feelings aside. Can you explain that?
Yeah, one of my chapters is called Hard Man, and it's an old British term from the north of Wales and southern Scotland, a term of total approval for a really good climber who also is very callous to other people's feelings, very self-involved, and therefore capable of climbing when other people are too scared to climb or pushing on in the midst of horrible weather. And I think I became a hard man in my 20s and early 30s by doing that very thing, sealing off the gentler, more introspective side of myself so that I could climb at the highest level.
And seal off those incidents, you know, as
right.
well, so that you could climb at the highest level. And after the incident with Gabe, you go on to Harvard, you join the mountaineering club there. You have, you know, terrific climbing experiences, but also another death. A climbing partner, Ed, is there, and then he's not there.
Yeah, we had climbed the hardest climb of our lives, the west face of Mount Huntington in Alaska. And just hours before, all four of us had reached the summit, and we're climbing down as the storm is just beginning to come in. And Ed and I decided to go down first. It's almost pitch dark, and we stopped to set up a rappel on this ledge. Ed is standing right next to me, and to this day I don't really know what happened. But as he leaned back on rappel, suddenly the whole thing failed and he plunged away from me. I saw a spark in the dark, which I think was caused by his crampon skittering on the cliff. And he didn't say a word and fell, I knew, 4,000 feet, so far that he must have fetched up in a basin that we couldn't even climb down to look for his body.
David Roberts, when did it change? When did you start realizing that these things were still with you?
Well, you can't be a hard man forever. I mean, partly you just get, you use up your nine lives. I had too many close calls. And I'm rational enough to realize that I didn't escape them because I was a better climber. I was just lucky. I could have just as easily been me as Ed.
And we should say you're a good climber.
I mean,
you're acknowledged to be a good climber.
Yeah.
This is climbing.
This is what climbing's about. And also, I think I became more interested in other things. Getting married made a big difference because Sharon, my wife, not only was not a hard woman and was scared to death of climbing, but she opened up the gentler sides, my capacity for love, which had really been sort of cauterized, I think.
Mm.
And also, I found that I would worry about her worrying about me, which had never bothered me in my early 20s.
Mm. This is when you started realizing about, you know, the other people who were involved when somebody went climbing.
Yeah, 39 years after Gabe's death in the year 2000, I went back to try to find his sister and brother who were the only surviving members of his family. And what I learned from those encounters was deeply disturbing, but also ultimately hugely valuable. Marion was still in a fury with me 39 years later. She had never understood the accident because the newspapers got it completely garbled, mm-hmm. as they usually do. But she blamed me for it, and the version that had lodged in her head had me as the culprit.
Mm.
And as she said, with a curse, she said, "You let Gabe do the dirty work." And it's true, I did. Gabe's father, who was the only effective parent at the time, had been killed in a car accident just 3 months before Gabe was killed. When Gabe got back from his father's funeral service, I said, "Gee, Gabe, I'm really sorry to hear what happened. And the first thing he said, he just blurted out, he said, "That's okay, when can we go climbing again?"
Hmm.
And when we started climbing again, I had actually been the stronger climber. But after that accident of his father's death, Gabe became this stronger climber and nervier and gutsier. What I blame myself for is that at 18, I didn't realize that this wasn't suicidal on Gabe's part, but it was right out there on the edge. There was a kind of despair operating behind that apparent skill and nerve.
Dave Roberts speaking to us last December, his book On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. When we come back, Dave's thoughts on this month's climbing deaths and a reminder of our top story, Saddam Hussein now headed to the gallows in Iraq. We'll have more on that as well, all coming up here and now. It's Here and Now, still to come, a legal scholar on the imminent execution of Saddam Hussein. But first, in light of the recent climbing deaths on Oregon's Mount Hood and in China, we're revisiting our conversation with adventure writer David Roberts, an elite climber who ultimately decided climbing wasn't worth the risk. His book, On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. We're going to get Dave's reaction to the recent climbing news in a moment, but last year we asked him about life after giving up the highest peaks.
One of the sad things is I've never found anything that replaced climbing for me.
No. Wait, what do you say? Is it an addiction?
Probably an addiction. But it's also this quest for transcendence, for living a life that's so vivid and vital and dangerous that everything else doesn't matter while you're out there. And I haven't found that even doing wonderful expeditions all over the world of slightly less dangerous kinds.
But are you saying that you have given up the kind of climbing that might leave a widow in its wake? And I'm thinking of sharing
well,
your wife.
Well, yeah. I still do climb at a modest level and as safely as I can. But climbing's always dangerous. I've had friends who've attempted the same strategy to climb at a mellow level in safe places in their later decades, and some of them have been killed. But I think I've found a way to do the little climbing I do, so it's just fun and not scaring me to death half the time.
Or scaring your wife to death.
Or scaring Sharon half to death.
It's funny, you come to this recognition that, you know, there are other people affected by what a climber chooses to do. And you say at one point you wish, you know, you'd been a better son to your parents, knowing how they were feeling when you went climbing.
Yeah, I on my very first expedition on Mount McKinley, the seven of us got reported missing and feared dead. And so for a long weekend, 3 days, Mom and Dad figured the chances were that I was dead. And it took me decades again to realize what that must have put them through. In fact, we sort of joked about it. We seven climbers would turn it into a joke later about the Boulder Daily Camera wrote a really corny article about Dad sitting there agonizing, and we would quote lines as if they were jokes from some old melodrama to each other.
And now you realize how he must have felt.
Yeah, and I have much more appreciation for the fact that they never tried to talk me out of climbing, that even after these deaths, they never lectured me or were overprotective. And I asked my mother just the other day why she never tried to get me to stop climbing, and she said, it wouldn't have worked. You'd have done it anyway.
Are you getting criticized by climbers who are saying, hey, you've sold out?
It's interesting. The strongest reactions I've had have been from other climbers who cannot stand to see their beloved pastime treated this way. I have a very good friend who feels that in his life, that climbing saved his life, that he might have ended up being a bum or a heroin addict without it. And for him, climbing is just an unalloyed good, even though he's had friends die in the mountains.
That's climber Dave Roberts speaking to us last December. His book is called On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. And we have Dave on the line from Utah where he's hiking because we want to get his opinion after the recent climbing tragedy in Oregon and the identification of the body of climber Charlie Fowler in China. The search goes on for Charlie's partner, Christine Boskoff. And Dave, we know you don't want to second guess any of these climbers, but they seem to underscore your point that even the most elite experienced climbers run a risk that may not be worth it to people waiting at the bottom.
Yes, I mean, this happens every year. Very experienced climbers die and disappear, and in some ways when we in the climbing community are not surprised when it happens, even though it's still sort of shocking.
You know, we always hear from climbers after we speak with you or Ed Viesters or other climbers. In fact, we spoke with Ed Viesters recently, and you co-authored a book with him about climbing. He's adamant that the way he climbs and the fact that he is so careful minimizes the risks. In the book, you have a big debate about that. But there are going to be climbers who are adamant in that opinion.
Well, Ed is an extreme rationalist, and he believes that he can almost completely control the risk. And you're right, we did have quite a to and fro about that. But so many of Ed's friends have died that that almost gives the lie to his idea that one can control the risk.
I just want to ask you about some other things we've heard from listeners, again, after reporting on the deaths in Oregon. We've heard from climbers. Rob Meltzer is one from here in Massachusetts who writes that there's a group of climbers who leave instructions, explicit instructions, requesting that they not be rescued because they recognize the risk that they're taking and they don't believe they should jeopardize the lives of potential rescuers. In fact, he wrote me again and said, I wouldn't even put on a locator.
Well, I think that's really admirable, that ethic. I'm not going to risk other people's lives trying to find me. It's totally my responsibility. I think it's interesting in the two recent disasters that the guys on Mount Hood took a cell phone and tried to make a rescue call, whereas Charlie and Christine clearly went off without any backup, no safety net, and were not expecting anybody to even look for them, let alone rescue them.
Right, they didn't tell people pretty much even
where they were going.
Dave, you know, we also hear from the climbers who say, It's still safer than crossing the street.
That's nonsense. It's unless you cross the street very dangerously. And it is one of the oldest cliches that climbers use to justify what they're doing.
But what do you say? I mean, you have these, you do have these debates. As we said, you had one with Ed Viesters in the book you both wrote. I'm sure you have them all the time with climbers. Is this just going to be something that is always going to be with us, you know, this debate about whether or not it's worth the risk?
I'm afraid so. And on the evening news, I was disturbed to see at the memorial service of the Mount Hood climber whose body was found that they gave airtime to the very sentiment that I say is of all the cliches, the tritest, quote, at least he died doing what he loved best. I just can't believe that there's any real solace in that for the ones left behind.
Dave Roberts, his book is On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined, a terrific read. Dave, thanks for letting us check in with you.
Thank you, and thanks for rebroadcasting.
And happy hiking.
Okay.
Now a quick update of our top story. Saddam Hussein's execution is reportedly imminent. Today, a Shia cleric in the holy city of Najaf described the news as God's gift to Iraqis, but the Pentagon says U.S. forces have been put on high alert. They expect Saddam's Sunni supporters to react to his death by hanging. We'll continue to cover the story. Next up, a legal scholar weighs in. Stay with us here and now. Funding for Young, It's Here and Now. Iraqi officials are saying that Saddam Hussein will be executed by tomorrow at the latest. It's now evening there. The former Iraqi president has been transferred from Camp Cropper, an American military prison, to Iraqi government officials who will hang him. On Tuesday, an Iraqi appeals court upheld Hussein's death sentence for the killing of 148 people in the town of Jujail in 1982. And earlier today, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said, "Our respect for human rights requires us to execute him without delay." Well, we turn now to Case Law School Professor Michael Scharf, who helped train Iraqi judges and prosecutors in the special tribunal system set up to hear this first war crimes case against Saddam Hussein. Professor Scharf joins us from the studios of WCLV in Cleveland. And first of all, Professor, the appeals court gave Iraqi officials 30 days to begin carrying out that sentence. It seems that they only waited a few. What are you hearing from Iraq?
Well, Robin, the folks I'm talking to say that they don't want this to become a martyrdom issue, and they'd much prefer to just treat him as an ordinary criminal who's had his day in court, he's had his decision affirmed, and he's then going to be given his punishment.
Well, what is the rush? Because, as you well know, there's criticism from human rights groups that there has been a rush to execute, that the appeals process went too quickly. There's other criticism that this robs Iraqis of the opportunity to have Hussein present at other trials that are scheduled for other war crimes. So what is the rush?
Well, and part of the problem is there are six of these trials that Saddam Hussein was ultimately going to stand during. And the second one, the Anfal campaign trial, has been going on since August. It's halfway through.
And this is the charge that Saddam Hussein mass murdered some 180,000 Kurds in the late 1980s.
Right, and that's much worse than the crime that he has been convicted of in the Dujal trial, the very first trial. So many people wanted to make sure that he would still be around to face this charge. And then the next case is going to be about the attacks of the Southern Marsh Arabs, which was, again, 200,000 or 300,000 deaths. Mm. And what this means is he won't be around for that. So that's one of the big criticisms. However, the other side of the coin is that during these trials, he has really been hijacking the proceedings. They've been televised in Iraq, gavel to gavel, and people watch it. And what he does is he has a right to cross-examine anybody after his lawyer is done. And he uses the cross-examination to make all sorts of crazy speeches where he incites people to violence. And so finally, the people in authority, the judges, the people in the government, and also the ordinary people in the street have just gotten tired of it. They've said, look, Saddam Hussein is now irrelevant to us. So since he has been found guilty in this first trial and that has been affirmed, why keep him around? Let's just go through the regular process.
What do you think, Professor, that will, you know, the impact of that will be on Iraqi law ultimately? Because, you know, one interpretation of that could be that, you know, they're getting rid of a voice that's an irritant by killing him, as opposed to letting the process carry out no matter how irritating it is.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. But the process in the first trial did carry out. I mean, it was 2 years of preparation before the trial began. The trial itself was a year long. every day of the trial, Saddam got to speak, and it was televised. It took them 3 months to write the trial court opinion. The opinion, by the way, is 298 pages, single space. And there's very few people in the world, except for maybe myself and a few others, who have read through every page of that. And one thing that you're struck with when you read the actual opinion is that these judges actually did a credible job. The findings of fact are extremely detailed. This is going to be a historic piece of legacy that people can look at and understand sort of the character of the Saddam Hussein regime in years to come. They did a credible job, and because of that, I think the appeal was fairly easy for them. And it does seem like they rushed it a little bit, because in the United States, we're used to seeing a written appeal come out at the same time they make the decision.
Well,
Iraqis have bifurcated that.
Well, what do you think of some of the criticisms today, though? I mean, Saddam Hussein's lawyer is saying by international law, he is a prisoner of war held by the U.S., and he can't be handed over to his adversary for execution. Do they have any legal standing there?
That's just ridiculous. First of all, he can't be a prisoner of war because sovereignty passed to Iraq 2 years ago. So even though the U.S. held him in custody, it was at the will of the Iraqi government. And whatever they wanted, the United States would have had to have done.
We're talking to Michael Sharp, professor at Case Law School. And it sounds as if you're saying that you know, while the trial was a mess, you know, outbursts from Saddam Hussein, judges yelling, lawyers assassinated. It sounds like you're agreeing with the Washington Post editorial that justice will be imperfect, but it will be justice.
Right. And even in the United States, the Supreme Court has said no one is guaranteed a perfect trial. No trial is perfect. And when you're prosecuting people who are former leaders, they're always really messy trials. And this probably will go down in history as the messiest of all. But if you look carefully at the written opinion of the trial court, and if you look at everything in the context, I think at the bottom you'll say, well, it wasn't a miscarriage of justice. I mean, the case was proved. Saddam did have his day in court. In fact, a year of days in court. And at the end of the day, justice was done.
What about an imperfect execution? We're reading about the hanging system in Baghdad, and it seems far from perfect, with ropes that break and bang the person who's been hung against a cement wall. What kind of image does that leave? I mean, is there any chance that that might be altered in any way? Because we know that there was some discussion of new gallows being built at Camp Cropper or some other form that doesn't, you know, leave an image that perhaps the U.S. doesn't want to be associated with.
Well, the whole idea of hanging is pretty controversial. You know, Saddam has asked for a firing squad, and it's been denied because the statute of the court says that the only penalty for execution is hanging. That's because a firing squad is normally given to military heroes, whereas hanging is what you give to common thugs and criminals, and that's what they're trying to make him into. Ultimately, I hope they don't try to televise this or make this a big public event where people watch it. It would be better for all, I think, if they just announce sooner than later that the execution has gone off, and here are some photos to show that Saddam really is no longer with us, so that he's not a martyr, or people don't think he's like Elvis and might be coming back. The real problem, though, is that under Islamic law, you cannot cremate people. You have to bury them. And if Saddam is buried somewhere in Iraq, that place is likely to become a shrine of people who will make pilgrimage there. And those people will always see him as a hero and may be the kinds of people who will use that as a rallying cry for continued insurgency and civil war.
Well, that's interesting, Professor Sharp, because the Iraqi government is saying one of the reasons they want to rush this execution through is they feel that Saddam Hussein has been sparking the insurgency. It sounds like you're saying that his being dead might not change that.
Well, you know, even the execution itself, I think, will have an effect on the insurgency. I don't think it will be a tipping point, and I don't think that he will become a martyr and that people will have jihad and say, remember Saddam. In fact, I think many of the people who are involved in the secular violence right now in Iraq aren't doing it on behalf of Saddam, but for a variety of other reasons.
Michael Sharp, director of the Frederick Cox International Law Center at Case School of Law, speaking to us from the studios of WCLV in Cleveland, Ohio. Professor Sharp, thank you.
Good to talk to you, Robin.
Well, still to come today, as newly declassified documents reveal that President John F. Kennedy received death threats during his 1963 visit to Ireland, we'll tour an exhibit that traces that journey. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, like clockwork, we pose the question, what's your New Year's resolution? Well, producer Heidi Pickman ponders hers.
I don't make grand resolutions like, I will be a better person. I usually pick something practical. The year I got one too many parking tickets, I vowed never to get another parking ticket again. All right, well, for the next year anyway. At the beginning of this year, I decided on something more ambitious, to learn a new skill. The year flew by as it usually does, and I forgot all about my new skill resolution until right after Thanksgiving. So now what, I thought. I had always wanted to learn how to play the guitar, but could I do it by New Year's? A friend showed me a couple of chords. I could play a D chord and an A chord, but the basic C chord? Okay, so what about surfing? I did take a lesson over the summer. Loved it. I almost stood up on the board and wrote it in. So I went to my surf instructor.
You want surf lessons this time of year? Honey, nobody gives any lessons around here till like, you know, late May or June or something like that, okay?
Okay, what do I do now? I started to panic until I was hanging out with a friend who was knitting. She says, it's easy. I asked her, what could I make? A scarf, a hat?
A hat's pretty easy.
You think I can do it in 2 weeks?
I think you could do it in 2 days.
2 days? Okay, there's hope for me.
Yes. You don't have a very big head.
Phew. This year wouldn't be a total loss. My new skill? Knitting. I remembered for my birthday, someone gave me a knitting starter kit that included a video.
First of all, I want you to pick up the needles and get comfortable with them. Pick one of them each hand.
It showed all sorts of great stuff I could make. Gorgeous scarves, knitted bikinis, I couldn't wait to get started. I learned how to cast on, which is getting the yarn onto the needles. I cast on 10 stitches, success. Then I undid it to try again and couldn't. Finally, after dropping my needles, dropping yarn off the needles, crossing my stitches, winding the yarn around the needles, I got 20 stitches cast on. I figured out the rhythm and the knit stitch and the purl thing, and in about 2 hours I had a small square. But then I ran into problems, so I called my friend.
When I'm making the turn, I often end up with this big loop. And then my other problem is, when I'm purling, it seems like I end up with twice as many stitches.
She told me to seek professional advice. So I let my fingers do some more walking and ended up at Stitches from the Heart and found Terry Turk. She's a volunteer at the yarn store. Well, it's more than a yarn store. Volunteer knitters from all over the country send hats, baby blankets, sweaters, and other knit goodies to the store, then distribute them to hospitals. Terry knew just what to do.
Because the big stitch on the end doesn't have a loop on either side of it, it tends to elongate.
Terry's pointers were like a knitter's guide to life, like not to hold the string too tight. If it feels right and looks right, then it must be right, and to read the directions. And then do what you want anyways.
You have to be fearless about substituting. Once you learn the stitches and you learn how to choose needles, yarn, and so forth, and patterns, the more fearless you are, the better in making those changes.
I can't wait to see what my hat's going to look like.
It's going to look just fine, and it's going to keep some baby's head warm, and some mom and dad are going to think it's been wonderful that you've knitted for them.
I'm not so sure. New Year's is just days away. I've been knitting like mad. I'm still dropping stitches and picking up extra stitches when I purl, just not as often. But I don't hold the string too tight, and I am fearless about following the directions, or not. And I came up with a new life lesson. If you make a mistake, sometimes you fix it and move on, and sometimes you just move on. If I finish my hat before the year is out, I'm going to donate it to Stitches from the Heart, if they'll take it. And as for next year, I am going for something grander. I will be a better person. I resolved to make a dozen hats for the hospital, and of course, improve my knitting.
Good luck there, Heidi. Heidi Pickman knits one, purls two, usually on the beach in Los Angeles. Stay with us. A new look at JFK's trip to Ireland is coming up. That's Here and Now. Today reminded us of our report this past spring about a special exhibit devoted to President Kennedy's Irish visit. It's still at the Kennedy Library here in Boston and provides an intimate glimpse into what the president called one of the most moving experiences of his life. President Kennedy arrived in Ireland on June 26, 1963, just hours after his historic speech at the Berlin Wall. Curator Frank Rigg picks up the story.
He arrived in Dublin as the undoubted leader of the Western world from this triumphant moment in Germany. And for people in Ireland, this was an important moment, that this young man of Irish heritage, the first sitting president of the United States to visit Ireland, was here among them.
No country in the world, in the history of the world, has endured the hemorrhage which this island endured over a period of a few years of so many of her sons and daughters. These sons and daughters are scattered throughout the world, and they give this small island a family of millions upon millions who are scattered all over the globe, who have been among the best and most loyal citizens of the countries that they have gone to, but have also kept a special place in their memory, in many cases their ancestral memory, of this green and misty island. So in a sense, all of them who visit Ireland come home.
First place on the itinerary was County Wexford, which was where the Kennedys originated. And the first stop, morning of June 27th, was in New Ross. It was a port, and it was from that port that Kennedy's great-great-grandfather Patrick Kennedy departed to sail into the new, off to the New World. And he had gone there from his little village, little hamlet of Dungenstown, and boarded the sailing ship that brought him to East Boston. It was a very moving moment for Kennedy, although he joked about it, speculating on what he might have been doing as his great-grandfather not left there.
If he hadn't left, I'd be working over at the Albatross Company. Or perhaps for John D. Kelly. In any case, we're happy to be back here.
So from New Ross, they headed to Dungenstown to meet the Kennedy cousins, James Kennedy and his sister Mary Ryan. And Mrs. Ryan prepared tea and salmon sandwiches and cake. And Kennedy with his sisters and Eunice and Jean mingle very in a very relaxed manner in the farmyard. And it was just a very relaxed, very unofficial sort of event, just like a family gathering.
We want to express our thanks to Mrs. Ryan, who she and her friends who cooked all this. We promise we'll come only once every 10 years. And as I said inside, we want to drink a cup of tea to all the Kennedys who went and all the Kennedys who stayed.
You know, the Kennedy visit was filled with great humor. But while there, obviously, he'd come to Ireland with very serious thoughts about the world, about, obviously, the Cold War, because in many ways, Kennedy's visit brought Ireland into the mainstream of world affairs. His presence and his being in the presidency, I think, gave Ireland a little different perspective on the world.
Seems to me that in these dangerous days, when the struggle for freedom is worldwide against an armed doctrine, that Ireland and its experience has one special significance. And that is that the people's fight
which John Boyle O'Reilly said outlived 1,000 years, that it was possible for a people over hundreds of years of foreign domination and religious persecution, it was possible for that people to maintain their national identity and their strong faith. And therefore, those who may feel that in these difficult times, who may believe that freedom may be on the run, or that some nations may be permanently subjugated and eventually wiped out, would do well to remember Ireland.
June 28th, he had been to Cork in the morning and come back to Dublin, and his first stop in the afternoon was at Arbor Hill, which is close to Kilmainham Jail, where the leaders of the Easter Uprising in 1916 had been hanged, and their graves are there, and was made into a memorial. And Kennedy visited there with Sean Lamass, the Prime Minister of Ireland, and laid a wreath. There was a unit of Irish Army cadets who performed a drill, which very greatly impressed President Kennedy. And I think for him, this was the most powerful emotional point of his visit.
And this is where we all say goodbye.
On the last day of his visit, he flew from Dublin to the city of Galway, and from Galway went to Limerick, and thence to the airport at Shannon to board Air Force One for his departure. And he quoted a poem which Mrs. De Valera, the wife of the president, had recited to him the previous night at the state dinner that President and Mrs. De Valera had given for President Kennedy. And it's a poem about the River Shannon. It's a very lyrical verse about exile and desire to return home. And he had written it out on a piece of paper. And he has the paper, and you can see him. He has the paper weighted down by the silver urn. And he takes it out, and then he unfolds it and reads it.
"'Tis it is the Shannon's brightly glancing stream, brightly gleaming, silent in the morning beam, oh, the silent transit. Thus returned from travels long, years of exile, years of pain, to see old Shannon's face again, oh, the waters glancing. Well, I'm going to come back and see old Shannon's face again."
Of course, Kennedy never saw old Shannon's face again. Just a few months later, those same Irish cadets who so impressed him in Dublin stood as an honor guard as the president was buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Again, according to documents released today in Ireland, President Kennedy was the subject of 3 death threats 5 months earlier during his Irish visit. Here in Boston, the Kennedy Library's exhibit on the president's 1963 trip has been extended until September 23, 2007. It's called The Journey Home. Our thanks to library curator Frank Rigg. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, a happy and safe new year, and join us as we see what 2007 brings here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.